think I'll go ahead at this point. I'd like to take just a few moments to introduce our guest speaker to you, although I know he's familiar to many of you since he's a regular visitor and teacher for us. David Loy is a professor, writer, and Zen teacher in the Sambo Kyodan tradition of Zen Buddhism. He's a prolific author whose essays and books have been translated into many languages. David's articles regularly appear in the pages of Buddhist magazines, including Tricycle, Lion's Roar, and Buddha Dharma, as well as in a variety of scholarly journals. His most recent book is Eco Dharma, Buddhist Teachings for the Ecological Crisis. David teaches nationally and internationally on various topics, focusing primarily on the encounter between Buddhism and modernity, what each can learn from the other. He is especially concerned about social and ecological issues. David, thanks for joining us this evening once again. You want to go ahead and unmute?
How's this? Can you hear me okay?
We can. Very good. Hey.
Thank you, David. As usual, I'm delighted to be joining you this evening, to talk about something that I've actually never really talked about before, certainly not in this way. So I ask your tolerance here if it seems a little bit rich. Sorry, not rich. If it seems a little bit rough on the edges. But I really think it's a topic that we can no longer ignore. I think it has to become more central in the field of socially engaged Buddhism. But I'd like to start out acknowledging something that I think probably all of us are aware here, the death of Thich Nhat Hanh last week, who has been a very important figure for many of us, certainly including me. When I think of Thich Nhat Hanh, he really stands out for me as one of the two great sort of mountains of Dharma in the contemporary world, along with the Dalai Lama. And it's interesting, and I don't know if it's a coincidence or what, but both of them were exiles, are exiles, refugees. And although, you know, treated better than most refugees are treated, I wonder what difference that inevitable suffering might have made and sort of helped even deepen their practice and their own personal transformation. Thich Nhat Hanh is especially relevant in another way, in that he was the first, as far as I know, to talk about engaged Buddhism. In a way, he sort of started it off, but now I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself. Let me sort of back up. One of the things that I really appreciate about the Buddhist traditions, all of them, is the emphasis on impermanence and insubstantiality, right? Whereas so many religions, it's about sort of finding that which doesn't change, that we can sort of ground ourselves in something like God. In the case of Buddhism, there's this incredible emphasis on the fact that everything changes. Nothing has any sort of essential nature. Everything is interdependent. And I think it's also really important that that applies to the Buddhist tradition itself. As we can see, the way that Buddhism changed, for example, when it went to China. My own practice has been Zen in Japan, but that derived from China. It's not something that the Buddha ever taught. It's something that developed in China when Mahayana interacted with Taoism. Likewise, Tibetan Buddhism. The Buddha never taught Tibetan Buddhism, but that's what happened when Mahayana Tantric Buddhism went to Tibet and interacted with the native Bon traditions there. So it does raise this really interesting question. What's happening to Buddhism now, say in the last half century, now that it has come not just to the West, but to the modern world, and it's become, you know, quite popular, in some ways quite even influential. What are the big changes going on there? Probably the most influential would be something like the secular mindfulness movement, which is not so much about Buddhism itself, but it does, you know, refer to the impact of Buddhism on society. But if we look at Buddhism itself, frankly, it seems to me that probably the most important movement, and maybe I'm just speaking personally, but I would say the most important development in the West has been socially engaged Buddhism, or as Thich Nhat Hanh said, engaged Buddhism. It's still quite interesting that I think it's the case that for many people, they would still believe that the kind of social engagement that I'll be talking about is something that's a distraction from the real practice. And it might be something that we occasionally need to do, but you know, the real practice is about meditation and other types of sort of mindfulness training. And so I think it's really important to appreciate that in the most important sense, socially engaged Buddhism is a kind of return to what the Buddha himself taught. The way the Buddhist traditions developed in Asia, in order to survive and thrive, they had to come to some accommodation with the state, with kings and emperors and so forth. And basically what that meant is Buddhism developed in a way that focused very much on individual transformation and sort of couldn't develop the social implications. But when we go back to the earliest teachings that we have, the Pali Canon, I think it's very clear that the Buddha was very much resonating with what we now understand as socially engaged Buddhism. What's happened in the last, 40 years or so it seems to me, maybe 50 years, socially engaged Buddhism has been through a number of different waves. It's developed and focused on different things at different times. And again, I'm struck how each of those resonates with a concern that the Buddha himself expressed in the Pali Canon. And what I want to end up focusing on, of course, is what I think needs to be the next step. Okay. I mentioned that Thich Nhat Hanh played a major role in the development of what we now know as engaged Buddhism. And of course, he was a major figure in the anti-war movement, basically caught between North Korea and the Viet Cong on the one side and South Korea on the other. And he refused to take sides. And for that reason, he ended up having to leave Vietnam and wasn't able to come back for a very long time. This focus on anti-war, it's interesting. Buddhism has a reputation of sort of being a kind of pacifist religion, but actually if you look at what's been going on in Asian Buddhism, that's not what you see. For example, in Japan, Japanese Buddhism was, with very few exceptions, very complicit with imperialism and what they call the Pacific War, the Second World War. The Buddhist institutions encouraged and supported it. More recently, we had a civil war in Sri Lanka, which was basically a kind of cultural religious war in that many of the Buddhists felt that the Tamils were, and the Hindu Tamils were a real threat. And so that ended up with a horrible kind of genocidal crushing of the Tamils. More recently in countries like Thailand and Burma, you know, you've even had sometimes Buddhist monks themselves talk about, it's okay to kill communists because they're not real people, and sort of encouraging intolerance against Muslims today. So there's lots of counter evidence, unfortunately, to this idea that Buddhism is pacifist or nonviolent. Nonetheless, if we go back to the Pali Canon, there are two stories that really stand out that I think shows the that show the Buddha's attitude. One of them, there was a incipient battle between two different tribes or groups because there was a drought, and they were basically arguing over who had the water rights to a river. And they were just about to really have a fully pitched battle when the Buddha appeared, according to this story. I mean, it may very well be a myth, but that doesn't deny the point of the story. The Buddha appeared and said, "What are you doing? I mean, blood is so much more important. Why would you do this?" And he was actually able to persuade them to stop. And there was another situation, a bit complicated, where a kingdom was really angry at the Buddha's own sort of homeland, the Shakya tribe. And he was actually able to sort of stop their invasion for a while, but eventually, as it said, the karma was too strong. And get this, in the lifetime of the Buddha, the Buddha's own tribe, the Shakyas, were basically destroyed, wiped out. So there is this definite element of nonviolence in the Buddhist teachings, as one would expect. And that was the focus in the early days, say in the mid-70s, when, say, the Buddhist Peace Fellowship started. And then after that, there were a couple other focuses, in particular, gender issues, what you could say kind of Buddhist feminism, LGBTQ issues as well. It's very significant that, again, if we look at the Buddha himself, he was quite revolutionary in the way that he created a bhikkhuni sangha. The story of how we did that is in the Pali Canon, and it seems to say that the Buddha did it in a very grudging way, like he didn't really want to do it. But the actual details of the story are very sort of suspect. It really, as I read the story, it's trying to blame somebody else. Later, people are trying to blame Ananda, his attendant, for kind of encouraging the Buddha to create a bhikkhuni sangha. But the Buddha basically realized, right, women have the same Buddha nature, the same potential to wake up. And we have stories in the Pali Canon, of course, of bhikkhuni who did wake up and who wrote sort of prayers and poems about their experience. But frankly, pretty soon after the Buddha died, the sort of basic patriarchy in India and in the other Asian Buddhist societies kind of reasserted itself. And for the most part, the bhikkhuni sangha, the sangha for women monastics, pretty much died out. So one of the really interesting developments that's gone on in the West is a much more emphasis on this. Jack Kornfield talks about the feminization of American Buddhism, which is quite interesting. I notice, and I expect David Chernikov has as well, that when I offer workshops and retreats, it's not unusual to have 2/3 or more of the audience be women. It's like the interest among women seems to be greater than among men. And it also works the other way around in terms of teachers. There are very few examples of women teachers in Asian Buddhist history. But of course now, I mean, that's simply something that we wouldn't tolerate. And, you know, we have wonderful examples of women teachers. For example, in the Zen tradition, I mean, most obviously the ones that just come to mind right now, Joan Halifax in New Mexico, but also Roshi Enkyo Ohara and Village Voice in New York, Village Zendo in New York. And perhaps the single most important Buddhist teacher, Pema Chodron, who now I believe might be sort of retired, but again, a really good example of how it is that American Buddhism, not only do we have very large numbers of women practicing, but also the voice of women teachers has become increasingly important within the last generation, which I think is a wonderful thing, of course. Something else that goes along with that, I don't know if we can say it developed at the same time or maybe a little bit later, is emphasis on becoming more aware of racism. Actually, there are two dimensions to this. I'm part of that sort of first cohort, well, no, 60s cohort of convert Buddhists who, you know, became very interested in Buddhist practice in the late 60s, early 70s. Most of us were white, middle class, and naturally, many people of color didn't feel comfortable in those kinds of sanghas. And I think many of us at that time were just sort of insensitive to that reality. It also worked in terms of Asian Buddhists, right? It's like, even today, most of the Buddhists in the United States are not white convert Buddhists or even black convert, they're Asian, they're cultural Buddhists, they're, you know, Vietnamese or Cambodian or earlier Chinese or Japanese who've come to America. And there has been a real split there in the sense that the world of the convert Buddhists and the world of the sort of ethnic Buddhists, sometimes it hasn't really sort of crossed over very much. But in particular, in terms of issues of color, that has been very problematical, and especially internally. So one of the really important things that's happened in the last couple decades is greater sensitivity to this phenomenon. And this is still, you know, this is still in process, but it's really wonderful to see how so many Buddhist sanghas in the United States are making a real effort to sort of become aware of these issues and find ways to be more open to people who are not simply, you know, white middle class folks. So we have very fine teachers like Angel Kyodo Williams and Lama Rod Owen. Again, we can connect this with what the Buddha said, because if you go back to what the Buddha created, one of the most important aspects of the Bhikkhu Sangha and the Bhikkhuni Sangha that he created, right, is that there's no caste. India at the time of the Buddha, caste was pretty important. And yet when you join the Sangha, you lost all caste. You weren't even supposed to talk about it. And this played out in a number of different ways. I'll just mention one of them. The monastics were, for the most part, they didn't work, right? They depended on being supported by society. And that meant they had to go begging in the morning. And they were not allowed to discriminate who they went begging from. In other words, in a caste society, even today, one of the most important things is your caste determines who you're allowed to eat with and who's allowed to touch your food. That's really, really important. And yet for the Buddhists, they were not allowed to discriminate. So you might have a very high caste Brahmin who became a monastic, but he would go begging food from an untouchable or a worker, somebody very low down caste. So we can see a wonderful example in the life and the teachings of the Buddha there as far as sort of overcoming those kinds of issues. A fourth development that has become very important, but only more recently, and frankly, I've been surprised how long that has taken to catch on. It's what we sometimes call eco-dharma or eco-Buddhism. That is to say, applying Buddhist teachings to understanding and addressing the ecological crisis that we face now. Again, it's been very slow, slower than I would have expected. You know, way back in 2009, I co-edited a book. I don't know if this will show in the screen. Let's see. A Buddhist Response to the Climate Emergency. This was published by Wisdom back in 2009. probably most of you have never heard about it because somehow it never got any traction. It never took off. There's lots of good stuff in there, and yet, for the most part, Buddhism at that time doesn't seem to have been ready to really move in this direction. And so I'm really pleased that since then, I think things have really taken off. We've benefited from Joanna Macy's work and the organization that she set up, right? The work that reconnects. We have One Earth Sangha based in Washington. We have the Rocky Mountain Eco Dharma Retreat Center that, you know, we founded in the mountains above Boulder here about 5 or 6 years ago, and so forth. Now, one can't claim that, you know, the Buddha was talking about carbon emissions or ecological crisis some 2,400 years ago. But again, there are all kinds of implications within Buddhist teachings that can be and have been sort of spun out. You know, the Buddha's relationship with the natural world, especially trees. I've been fascinated by the parallel between what Buddhism has always taught about our individual predicament, and especially the roots of that in this delusion of separation, duality, the anatta teaching focusing on the denial that there's a separate self-existing self. And it seems to me that actually that really also points to the root of the ecological crisis, that it ultimately comes back to the fact that we as a species, or at least our sort of contemporary civilization, we feel this disconnect, we feel this alienation from the earth, and therefore we feel that we're sort of quite we can destroy, we can take advantage of the natural world quite heedlessly because we don't feel a part of it. We don't feel that our well-being is immediately connected with or identified with the well-being of the earth. Of course, now with the ecological crisis, we're learning that it very much is. So what I've just offered is a kind of a overview of sort of as what I've seen as these different waves of socially engaged Buddhism, starting with anti-war, gender issues, racism, people of color issues, and also eco-dharma. And I think now we can see pretty clearly that there's something missing that from this, that something more is needed. And the way it works for me, the way it's developed for me, has to do with trying to understand why it is that we as a civilization are finding it so difficult to respond appropriately to the greatest challenge that humanity has ever faced, as Chomsky put it, the ecological crisis. Not only the climate crisis, but the much larger one in terms of many different types of pollution, a loss of biodiversity, et cetera, right? Why are we finding it so difficult? And basically, I think what we need to start acknowledging is that the ecological crisis is not just having to do with biodiversity and climate. Many people have made the important connection between eco-dharma and, say, people of color. It's no accident in the United States that many poor people of color just happen to be living in places that are especially polluted, where they have especially bad air. It's really important to see that connection between the ecological crisis and why it is that some people are suffering more than others, right? But what I want to highlight now is another important factor. And what sort of brought this to my mind was when I came across this really stunning fact. And here's what it is. In the 25 years between 1990 and 2015, right? 25 year period when we knew we had a climate crisis, and yet we really didn't do very much about it. In fact, rather than reducing emissions, I think they went way up, maybe as much as 60% up from the way they were back in 1990. But here's the fact that sort of I think we need to focus on. During this 25-year period, the wealthiest 1% of the world's population were responsible for more emissions than the bottom 50% of the world's people. Not only that, the top 1% were responsible for twice the carbon emissions of the bottom 50%. Please think about that for a moment. What's going on there? We can enlarge that. The richest 10% of the global population, about 630 million people, as some people calculate it, were responsible for over half of the total emissions during that period. Again, 10%, and let's be honest, that probably includes, it certainly includes many of us listening to this talk, including me giving the talk, because if you earn $35,000 a year or more, you're in the global top 10%, right? In terms of the 1%, that's a little more controversial. I've read that if you earn $100,000, some people say $170,000, but certainly $35,000 is a relatively low benchmark for many of the people, I think, listening to this talk today. George Monbiot, who writes for The Guardian, has pointed out that the richest 1% on average emit over 70 tons of carbon dioxide per year, which is 30 times more than we can afford to release if we're going to keep it down to one, if we're going to keep global warming down to no more than 1.5 increase in temperatures Celsius. Excuse me for giving you these figures, but I'll try to keep them at a minimum, but I think they're really important as far as helping us understand the basic point here that the ecological crisis is deeply implicated into the basic structure of our economic system and the way that it works to aggravate and increase the gap between rich and poor. In other words, the ecological crisis, I'm arguing, is also a class crisis. And frankly, I doubt very much we're ever going to be able to address it successfully, responsibly, without acknowledging and also finding some way to address the kind of economic predicament that we're in now, right? One issue, of course, is that wealthy people and especially wealthy corporations have sometimes devoted quite a bit of money in terms of propaganda, persuading us that either the climate crisis isn't real or it's not that bad, or sometimes that there's nothing we can do about it. In various ways, trying to keep our attention from focusing on it and doing what we need to do in response. I was quite struck by something Noam Chomsky said. See if I have it here. He refers to Rex Tillerson, who was the Secretary of State under Trump for a while, but his background, of course, was that he was the CEO of ExxonMobil, which devoted enormous resources to climate change denial, even though he knew, the ExxonMobil scientists, they knew themselves what was happening. And Chomsky puts it really well when he says, quote, "I don't know what word in the language, I can't find one, that applies to people of that kind who are willing to sacrifice the literal, the existence of organized human life, so they can put a few more dollars in highly overstuffed pockets. The word evil doesn't begin to approach it." Speaking more generally about the wealth gap, Bernie Sanders has pointed out that the top 1%, no, 0.1%, 0.1%, have been the really big winners over the last half century, right? In 1963, that 0.1% had about 10% of the country's wealth, and now they have about 22%. In fact, and again, here's some staggering figures. The two richest people in our country own more wealth than the bottom 40%. Let me say that again. The two richest people in this country are wealthier than the bottom 40% of all the people. The top 1% of all, the top 1% wealthiest in this country own more wealth than the bottom 92%. During the pandemic, when thousands of essential workers died doing their jobs, some 700 billionaires in America became more than $2 trillion richer. I've read data that says the top 10 wealthiest people in this country basically doubled their wealth in the last 2 years, just in the last 2 years, right? Please think about what this means. Think of what some of these billionaires are doing, you know, rather than doing everything they can to sort of address the ecological crisis, right? Some of them are thinking about, well, let's go to Mars and terraform that. Or you have many of these multi-billionaires who spend hundreds of millions of dollars on these super yachts, these mega yachts, which frankly, let's be honest, they are their survival machines. When things get really bad, right? You can be sure that they're stuffed full of all kinds of things that they will need to survive if they need to go off and you know, be portable. What this connects with, I think, is we need to realize that the United States is really not a democracy. It's a democracy in form, but not in reality. And here I want to refer to a really important academic study by some Princeton and Northwestern professors. They published it back in 2014. And they wanted to see what influences Congress. How does Congress decide what to do? And they basically concluded, after very specific research, that the preferences of typical Americans have no influence whatsoever on congressional legislation, right? They analyzed 1,799 policy issues in detail, and they sort of weighed the relative influence of economic elites, business groups, interest groups, average citizen. And they concluded, quote, "The preferences of the average American appear to have only a minuscule, near zero, statistically insignificant impact on public policy. Lawmakers mainly listen to the policy demands of big business and wealthy individuals, those with the most lobbying prowess and deepest pockets to bankroll campaigns." And then the article that I have here, it says, it's probably far worse now because their data that they researched to reach this conclusion, it was from the period 1981 to 2002. This was before the Supreme Gate opened the floodgates of big money, that famous Citizens United case, before super PACs, before dark money, before the Wall Street bailout in 2008 and 9, right? In the last 20 years or so, corporate tax rates have plunged, regulatory protections for consumers, you know, gone way down, unions have been broken and are much less influential. Get this, the profits of big corporations have just reached a 70-year high, even during the pandemic. And again, maybe the most staggering statistic. Back in the 1960s, the average CEO pay in large corporations was about 20 times that of the average worker. Today, the average is about 320 times, right? That gap between the average worker and how much the CEOs are earning, from 20 times to 320 times in the last 50 years, right? Whereas most Americans are going nowhere, the typical worker's wage is only a tiny bit higher than it was 40 years ago, adjusted for inflation. And as one might expect, one big casualty of this has been public trust in democracy. In 64, just 29% of voters believed that government was run by a few big interests looking out for themselves, right? 29% were cynical about government. Today, or no, by 2013, and I'm sure it's worse now, by 2013, 79% of Americans believed it, right? I mean, if we want to try to understand some of the developments that have happened in the last, you know, decade, I think this is important to realize. And one of them is what is sometimes called deaths of despair. The fact that, especially for non-college educated workers, the death rates from suicide, drugs, alcohol have just shot way, way up, because they don't see that they have much of a shot at the American dream anymore. Inequality in the United States has become greater than in France, Germany, Japan, or in any other of the major, what we think of as developed, technologically developed or advanced democracies, right? But see, well, but this is my point. We are not a democracy. We are a democracy in form, in the sense that we still have voting. But the reality is that we are better described as a plutocracy. A plutocracy is one form of oligarchy, which is when basically the government is controlled by the few for the benefit of the few. Another form of oligarchy is aristocracy, right? That's where you have like a hereditary caste of nobles. But the other one, which applies to us, is plutocracy. Basically, the country is run by wealthy people for the benefit of wealthy people, right? Let me just read you this definition of plutocracy. Quote, plutocracy refers to a society that's ruled or controlled by people of great wealth or income. It can refer to it being exclusively controlled by wealthy people directly or indirectly. Indirectly, wealthy individuals may not be directly involved in the administration, but they're going to influence it by legal and illegal methods such as bribing, sponsoring election campaigns, lobbying, dark money, et cetera, which I think pretty much sounds familiar to all of us today. Okay, that's enough sort of data, but I think that's something we need to take account of. And as I started out to say, I think we really can't understand why it is that we as a civilization are finding it so difficult to respond appropriately to the ecological crisis unless we also see that there is this extraordinary resistance on the part of many wealthy people and corporations who are simply benefiting too much from the way things are now, right? But let me just move on now and say, move to the Buddhist aspect. What does Buddhism have to say about capitalism, about this kind of phenomenon? Well, or what does Buddhism have to say about plutocracy? Well, in one way, it doesn't have anything to say about capitalism, right? That wasn't an issue in the Buddha's day any more than the climate crisis was. But I don't think it's all that difficult to apply a Buddhist perspective. And in particular, two things stand out. Number one is the way that the kind of economic system that we have now ends up rationalizing greed, right? On an individual level, greed would generally be perceived as a character defect. If we understand greed as you always want more, you never have enough, I think most of us would acknowledge that. When we see people like that, we think, you know, there's something a little wrong with them. And yet when we look at it in its institutional version, it's accepted as the kind of motor of the economic system, not only consumerism, advertising encouraging us to consume more and more, but the need for corporations to grow, that they're never profitable enough, their market share is never big enough, their stock prices are never high enough, and so forth. I think that's a pretty clear example. And we just need to remember that for Buddhism, greed is the first of the three poisons. Aristotle too, in the Western tradition, he talked about the problem with acquisitiveness, which is to say that it has no endpoint, right? Or in the terms that I like to use, when we talk about, I sometimes talk about lack projects in terms of, because the sense of self is a construct that's inherently insecure, and the way we experience this is we feel a sense of lack, and then we tend to look outside ourselves and say, oh, what I lack is this, I don't have enough of this. And I think it's pretty clear, you know, the number one lack project in the United States, I would say, is money, right? The emphasis on greed and acquisitiveness. And the problem with all lack projects is that they never provide what we're looking for. They're all, because they're symptoms of a more basic delusion, the delusion of separation. And what that means is if you see that your problem, if you think your problem is that you don't have enough money, you're never going to have enough money. So it feeds this need for always more and more. And I think it's pretty clear that's the most dangerous and the most destructive lack project going now. The other thing we can point out about our economic system, capitalism, is that it tends to devalue the natural world. It's, you know, in many traditions, think of indigenous traditions, think of Native American traditions. In just about every one of them that I know of, there's a sense of the sacredness, the sacrality of the natural world. And yet the problem that we see with capitalism is that it devalues the natural world into a means to an end of making money. Earth becomes resources, right? People become sources of labor. Money even itself becomes a means to making more money. It all involves the exploitation of all of these in order to keep the production of ever more capital, ever more money. But I want to close the Buddhist perspective on this phenomenon by saying a little bit about a particular sutta in the Pali Canon, in the Digha Nikaya, one of the longer discourses, which has something really interesting to say about the relationship between poverty, material poverty, and social deterioration. I think there's a real wisdom in this that we would be wise to sort of pay attention to. It's called the Lion's Roar Sutra in English, the Chakavati Sihanada Sutta, though I'm not sure of my pronunciation there. And it basically goes like this. In this sutta, the Buddha tells the story of a king in a distant past who initially he venerated and relied on Buddhist teachings, doing what his sort of monk advised, right? His sage advised, don't let crime prevail, and to those who are in need, give them property, right? But later he began to rule according to his own ideas, and he did not give property to the needy. So property became very widespread. Due to poverty, one man took what was not given. That's the Buddhist euphemism for stealing, right? One man stole and was arrested. And when the king asked him, "Why did you steal?" the man said, "Well, I have nothing to live on. I have nothing to support my family with." So the king gave him some property, saying, "Well, that'll be enough to carry on the business and support your family." Now, exactly the same thing happened to another man. And when lots of other poor people heard about this, they too, what do? They decided to steal so they would be treated in a similar way. Then the king realized that he got into some trouble, right? That if he continued to give property to people, then theft would continue to increase. So he decided what? Well, he had to get tough on the next thief. I'd better make an end to him, finish him off, and cut off his head. And so that's what he did. He started punishing people, executing people who stole. What's really interesting about this story is it seems to be moving in kind of a moralistic parable about deterring crime, but actually it turns in exactly the opposite direction. This is what happens. I'll just read a couple sentences here. Hearing about this, people thought, quote, "Now let us get sharp swords made, and then we can take from anybody what we want. We'll make an end to them. We'll finish them off and cut off their heads." He's using the same language as the king, but now they're going to use this to steal. "So having procured some sharp swords, they launched murderous attacks on villages, towns, and cities, went in for highway robbery, killing their victims by cutting off their heads, just like the king had done. Thus," this is the conclusion, "from not giving property to the needy, poverty became widespread, and from the growth of poverty, stealing increased, and from increase in theft, the use of weapons increased, and that increased the killing of people." Very interesting. It's not at all a parable about, you know, controlling crime. It's basically saying, if you don't help people deal with their poverty, society is going to deteriorate and fall apart. And in the rest of the sutta, that's what happens. And things get much, much worse until eventually people start to live in a moral way again, and the situation improves. Despite some fanciful elements, this myth has important implications, right? Poverty is presented as a root cause of immoral behavior, such as theft, violence, killing. And unlike what one might expect, you know, it's like maybe you might expect Buddhism to say, well, it's important to just kind of accept your karma if you're poor. You know, it must be because something you did, or maybe in a past lifetime. You might expect that to be the moral, but not at all. That's not what the Buddha is talking about. He's talking about the connection between increasing poverty and society falling apart. And I'm sure I'm not the only one who wonders if in some form some of that is happening with the United States today, right? The problem begins when the king doesn't give property to the needy. In modern terms, when the state neglects its responsibility to maintain a minimum of what we would call today distributive justice. This influential sutra implies that social breakdown can't be separated from broader questions about the benevolence of the social order. The solution to poverty-induced crime is not to punish severely, but to enable people to provide for their basic needs. And the question we need to ask, you know, are there parallels between what that is pointing out and the kind of situation we're seeing now with the incredible increasing gap between rich and poor, with these deaths of despair, with some of these popularist political movements. I think you know what I'm talking about here. How much can we understand some of the deterioration in the quality of our social life together in terms of this increasing gap between rich and poor? Anyway, let me conclude. Well, starting with a quotation from one of my favorite writers, Ursula Le Guin, who died a couple years ago. She was awarded a kind of a lifetime achievement award. I think it was the National Book Awards. And she gave a very famous talk, which included this little bit. We live in capitalism. Its power seems inescapable. So did the divine right of kings. Any human power can be resisted and changed by human beings. By the end of her life, she was certainly seeing the problem. Now, that's not to say that I have any simple solutions to offer here. All I can do to conclude with is to sort of make two points that I think are relevant to any attempt, any way forward here to address this. First of all, it's very clear that if you and I and other Buddhist practitioners are going to have any impact in addressing this kind of issue, it's not something that people can do individually. What I'm trying to say here is that there was, for a while at least, a lot of success when sort of fossil fuel corporations sort of persuaded people that the climate crisis was because of individual consumption, right? The problem is you and I, where our carbon footprint is too high, and so we need to focus on switching to hybrid or electric cars, solar panels on the roof. It's an individual problem, rather than realizing that it's something institutional that we really need to work on together. And clearly, this is very obvious now, that the problem that I'm trying to add to socially engaged Buddhism is something that requires us to develop much stronger sanghas and to find ways to work together politically. It's something that requires us to overcome the individualism that often American Buddhism kind of plugs into, you know, the focus on my own practice, my own enlightenment, my own equanimity and serenity. And even the individual helping other individuals, that's not enough. We really have to find ways to address what is a structural, if not the structural institutional problem that we face, right? Secondly, and finally, you don't need to be a Marxist to appreciate Marx's point that the people who control the economic system are going to control the political system. Or basically, I guess what I'm saying here is the whole point of my argument is to say they aren't two systems, right? We think of the economic system, we think of the political system. In reality, they're two sides of the same system. And the situation we're in now is, as Marxists would emphasize, the people, the wealthy, powerful people and corporations, they pretty much control the government. That's what a plutocracy is. What I think we need to acknowledge is that linkage is inevitable. And in order to address it, we need to focus on the other side. That is to say, we have to have a political system that controls the economic system much more than it does now. Maybe something like the social democracies in Scandinavian countries, for example. Again, I don't have particular full-blown, grown models to suggest, but what I think it's really necessary for us to focus on now is to realize that in addition to all the other issues that socially engaged Buddhism has been concerned about, anti-war, gender, racism, ecological, we also need to take a really good look at our plutocracy, the way our economic system works, the way that it's structured for the sake of the very wealthy people, and to understand how that interferes with addressing so many of the other types of problems. So this is what I think is missing from socially engaged Buddhism and what I think we need to start talking about and thinking about together. And I'll leave it at that for the moment. Thank you.
Thank you, David. We've got just a few minutes here, but how about if people have any comments or questions, are you open to
Of
a little
course,
bit
as
of
always.
a little bit of dialogue, maybe a
Please.
person or two.
Sure.
If any of you are unfamiliar with this Zoom platform, you can raise your hand by going to the reactions button at the bottom of your screen. And if you click on that, I'll see an icon. You'll click raise hand. I'll see your name come up in a queue and invite you to unmute so David and others can hear your comment or your question. You can also, if you have a comment, you can put it in the chat and I can share that with the group if you'd like to do it that way. Wynn, would you go ahead and unmute, please?
Hello, David. And David, thank you. And Sangha, let's see. I was just was aware that the other day I saw an electric car with custom license plates which read "no exhaust" in an abbreviated fashion, and I thought of that as ecological materialism. Someone who had the financial means to lower their footprint and was wearing it like a feather in their cap.
Thank you for that, Wynn. Yes, that's a really good point. I think it's a really good example of green consumerism. There's a kind of interesting parallel here, say, with the way that karma is understood in Thailand, right? And other Southeast Asian countries. It tends to be understood kind of materialized and or commodified as merit making. And if you give money to monks and temples, then you get merit, which will affect your future rebirth and so forth. And what that does in effect is that it encourages people. There's another reason to become really wealthy in Thailand, because if you become really wealthy, not only can you enjoy a really nice lifestyle, but you can also give some of your money to the monks, and what you're basically doing is preparing for your next lifetime, so you can feel good about yourself spiritually as well. I see a parallel between the two. I don't know if anyone else does, but certainly green consumerism, that kind of symbolic consumerism, yeah, that can be very problematical. Yeah. Thank you.
There's a comment here in the chat asking about the recording, David. Dorothy, what I'm going to do is I'm going to send the audio file to David, and he can help. You could put it up on your site or make it available to people who would like a recording of the talk, huh?
Yes, I'd be very happy to do that. And again, with apology, I've never talked about this before, so I appreciate this is really kind of rough, but I just think it's something we've got to start thinking about,
Well,
given.
like you said at the beginning, it's also kind of rich, so it's an okay combination.
Thank you, David. Dahlia?
Hi, thank you very much for this discussion, talk, and very thought-provoking. And thank you, David Chernikov, for also helping host. So something that recently just I found myself feeling irked. I was listening to a talk by Jack Kornfield, and he was talking some about the climate crisis. But then in the same talk, he was talking about all this international travel that he does. And I struggle with that when there are leaders in our community that are promoting eco-dharma and at the same time traveling all over the place, especially internationally. And I just, because I know that is such a major source of carbon footprint for an individual. So anyway, I just wanted to make a comment about that.
Thank you, because I think that's a really important issue. And to be frank, to be quite personal, it's one that I struggle with myself. I suppose there's a parallel here with meat. I've really cut back on my meat production, but I'm not I'm not a complete vegetarian, much less a vegan. And the same thing with air travel. I agree completely there that is a huge issue. What it comes down to for me, at least at this point, is that I'm still willing to travel by air when there's lots of teaching stuff going on. You know, it's like, say, I wouldn't travel to Europe to give, say, one talk or one workshop, but if it's possible to do a great number, then on balance, it seems to me that it might be still worth doing, despite the fact, of course, that most of the teaching now that I'm doing, well, almost all the teaching for the last 2 years has been by Zoom. How does one balance that? Yeah, it's a really great question, and I'm struggling with it, and I certainly don't see myself as a model in terms of providing the answer. I really appreciate your highlighting it because of the just the importance. Yeah, air travel involves a lot of carbon emissions.
Well, we are at about 9 o'clock. So just to repeat, Dorothy, if you want to contact David or go to his website, that would be one way you could arrange to have a copy of the recording. And what would be best, David? Should they go to your email you, or go to your website and use your contact page?
It's a good question. Basically, what I'm going to do when you send it to me is then I'm going to check with Vince, my webmaster, and he'll put it on my website. So I suppose it's a matter of checking my website. On my website, there's a page which talks about audio and video recordings, and it'll be at the top of that page. So people who would want to have access should simply check it once in a while. And I'll put it on there as soon as I can. Yeah.
How about if we close with a brief dedication of merit? If you want to take a comfortable position as we did when we did our meditation practice, just briefly before we close, let's remember why we're here and why we practice and why Sangha is important. So take a moment if you would and trust that you don't have to grasp at the concepts and ideas that David's been talking about, that those that are most relevant for you will be available to you when you want them or need them. And you also will have the option of going to his website to listen again to his talk. Yeah. You might take a nice deep breath into your heart center, at the center of your chest, which in many contemplative traditions is said to be the place where we remember who we are on the deepest level. And we remember that in this place we can separate ourselves from our separateness and experience our interconnectedness. Since David began by talking about Thich Nhat Hanh, I'd like to close with the words of Thich Nhat Hanh. Studying the teachings, practicing the way of awareness, gives rise to benefits without limit. We vow to share the fruits with all beings. We vow to offer tribute to teachers, parents, friends, and numerous beings who give guidance and support along the path. May it be so. David, thanks once more for your good, thought-provoking words. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
Thanks for the opportunity, David.
Mm. If any of you would like to unmute and just say a word or two before we wrap up, we can have a couple of minutes of joyful chaos in a mindful manner, of course.
Greetings.
Thank you to both of you, David and David.
Welcome.
Thanks, David. There was a lot to chew on.
Great talk.
Well, you're not appearing on.
Thank you, David. It's amazing.
Only my picture is on this. Okay.
Thank you, David. That was great.
Thank you both.
Welcome.
I'm not getting any.
I think we'll go ahead and wrap up at this point. Everyone be well. David, I'll be in touch. Everyone take good care. Stay healthy, please. Good night now.
You too. Thank you much, both of you.
Thank you. Good night. Good night.